In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome back to the House of Pod.
My name is Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I am the host of this fun little silly medical podcast covering the intersections of health, pop culture, and whatever else I want to cover. Today, I'm going to be covering fatty liver disease. It's something that people have wanted to hear about on the show for a while, and I've been, I don't know why, reluctant to do it. We'll get into that. But today we're doing it. We are going to do it. And to help me do it are two of my friends and two previous guests. We have Turner Sparks, comedian in New York City, whose comedy album Double Happiness is available on all streaming platforms. He is also one of the co-hosts of the podcast Lost in America. It's a news, right, Turner? But what you do is you'll do like international stories and you'll bring on comedians from whatever country you're covering the topic in. And so you guys do it in this funny, cool way. Turner, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back. I'm excited to be here.
It's good
and
to have
you. And yes, you nailed the description of my podcast. Nailed it.
Thank you. It's a good podcast.
Thank you.
I'm trying to think. You know, I want to get on your podcast, but I don't really fit because even though I am Persian, I am here. So I can't really help you that much with what's happening in Iran, which you should be covering, which is great. And still,
we are covering it. Yeah, we've done an Iran episode. We did one. We were actually thinking of doing one soon because it's the 1 year anniversary of the tragic events from a year ago. We did it a year ago with a comedian. But what we found our audience doesn't like, we learned this the hard way.
Iranians.
We're like, oh, we have a friend who's an American, but his parents are from that country. And they're like, boo.
Yeah, yeah.
But we want, it has to be somebody in the country, from the country. They want the accent. They want the authenticity.
Oh, I can do the accent, but no, not the authenticity.
Well, that's, yeah. What do we care? Let's just do that. We have no, you know.
No, I totally understand. I totally get that. And I'm looking forward to that episode. Joining us also, Dr. Elliot Tapper, hepatologist at the University of Michigan. Dr. Tapper, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
It's good to see you again, my friend. Today, we're going to talk about fatty liver. Let me start with this. Turner, let's just start with the basics. What do you know about the liver?
I know that if you drink too much booze for too long of a time, your skin gets kind of yellowish. Mm-hmm. And your eyes maybe also yellow. Everything mm-hmm. goes yellow. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then what? They tell you your liver is failing. You're going to die. And then you go, I can do one more drink. And then you die.
That's not too
that's
far off, right?
That's my basic understanding of the liver.
Let me ask a follow-up question, though. Why do you think it turns yellow?
It's something to do with the liver. There's a liver connection. The liver says, no, thank you. Thank you for all the alcohol, but I've been overserved. I'm giving you a signal, skin. Your skin's going to go yellow. And that means a slow down sign. You know, there's like red, green, and yellow. I'm learning as I talk here, you know?
You're working but through this. I'm working through this.
Yeah, but you know, there's a green and a yellow and then a red, and the red means stop. So red is that's when it's really bad. But yellow means slow it down, bro. And then you usually say, no, I can drive. Give me my keys.
Yeah.
And then you die. These stories end and you die.
Elliot, how did he do there?
Well, I would give that a B+. It's a pretty plus? Good.
You're giving him a B+.
It's a good start. It's a good start.
We'll take it.
It is interesting. The analogy of like the stoplight yellow. The problem in medicine is that sometimes when you get that warning, it's, you know, you're really at a red. You're already at a red, and the body, the signs are just catching up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Ideally, we meet people way before.
So
before the body, the skin turns yellow.
That's right.
Elliot, can you explain to Turner here why the body turns yellow when your liver has had too much alcohol?
Yeah. So the key point here is that when the liver starts to fail, because it's so important for everything that your body needs, the storage or making energy to feed the rest of the body, the processing and creation of so many proteins and critical functions in the body, when it starts to conk out, then crazy things start to happen. Like you turn yellow, you fill up with fluid, you forget who you are. And then the red part is you can be bleeding terribly in a life-threatening way. So our whole goal is to meet people before all of that damage arises. The yellow that you're talking about is that the liver actually processes most of the toxins and junk in the blood. And one of the junk parts that it gets rid of is the stuff from rusty old red blood cells. So when your red blood cells have reached the end of their life, they're disassembled, and some of the parts have to be flushed out in our urine and poop. And if the liver is all jacked up and it can't process that kind of stuff from the blood, flush it out, then it will back up and it will literally stain your skin yellow because of that.
Turner, the liver is like super important, but I don't think that people outside of medicine understand that. I don't feel like the liver gets respect. As a liver doc myself, I don't feel like the liver gets respect in the commonplace public. Do you feel like you have underappreciated your liver?
Yeah. Well, 100%. Yes. Because the problem is these Heineken and these companies, they didn't start coming out with zeros until like 2 years ago. So
wait, where zero, before is that, zero calorie or zero like alcohol?
No. The zero alcohol stuff. You know, that's all new. So your option was like O'Doul's, which like is disgusting, or, you know, a Diet Coke or something. So I think everyone mistreats their liver. I don't know what, this is a question I would have for all of you, if I'm allowed to start asking questions here.
Please.
What is too much for your liver? What is too much alcohol for your liver? And a follow-up would be, is alcohol the only thing that negatively affects your liver? That's all we get taught negatively affects it, but there could be more things I don't know about.
Well, I love these questions. And so starting with like the harder one first, which is how much alcohol is too much alcohol? And I think the World Health Organization is coming out saying any alcohol is too much. But it's so ingrained within our culture, that's kind of a hard place to start. So in general, we would say that 7 standard drinks, like a glass of beer, 4 ounces of wine, a shot of a hard liquor, that's about the limit for a week for a woman, 14 for a man. And that's because the way that we each metabolize alcohol is different. And then there are some people where even that amount is even more toxic. For example, they already have liver disease or they have bariatric surgery. And so where the alcohol just hits the liver a lot faster. But, you know, so typically when we meet people in a liver clinic, they're not usually just cruising above that level. They're drinking an amount that would not surprise them to learn is actually toxic. So usually it's not a borderline kind of case. I think the other question, which is super important, is that I think a lot of people know alcohol in the liver, but it turns out the most common cause of liver problems is something that used to be called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is basically like liver diabetes, where the liver will fill with fat and inflammation because of things like type 2 diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol. But there's also infections of the liver, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, hepatitis A, and some rare autoimmune conditions.
And that gets us into really what we're going to talk about today, which is fatty liver disease, or there's a new terminology for it, which I'll have you explain in just a moment, Elliot. But the liver disease that comes, it in some ways looks very similar to alcoholic liver disease. It can, but it's not due directly to alcohol. So, Elliot, will you tell us a little bit more about fatty liver, like, and what we call it now and what causes it?
Yeah. So the most important thing to remember is that the liver processes all of the calories, all the energy that we take in. And if you are taking in too much energy, or there's signals that are tricking it to holding on to too much, it will start to balloon up with fat. The liver will actually get fatty. It will turn yellow with fat. And for some people, that fat will catch on fire and start causing inflammation in the liver. So when there's fat in the liver, we would call that fatty liver or steatotic liver. That's the fancy word for it. So back in the day, when this condition was first discovered, it was called non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, where it was the steato is the fat and hepatitis, the itis of the liver. So, when it was first described, it was literally some guy going to patients saying, do you swear you're not a drinker? And then they would also ask the family, are you sure they didn't drink any alcohol? Because for all intents and purposes, it just looks the same. The alcohol tricks the liver into getting fatty, and there's extra calories. For some people, when it catches on fire, when it gets inflamed, you can pick this up in the blood with elevated liver tests more often than not. But what the problem is, and the reason why I have a job, is that when the inflammation is going on in the liver, it's like there's a fire. And if you burn yourself, your skin turns red. But eventually, that redness, that inflammation goes away, and you're left with a scar. And that scar will replace the good parts of the liver. It will bend the liver out of shape. And then you start getting all of those symptoms of advanced liver disease, the jaundice, the fluid buildup, and so forth. Cirrhosis, in other words. That's the thing that I worry about, we want to intervene on before we meet people like that.
So how do you get fatty liver if it's not from alcohol?
Yeah. So literally what is happening is that people, if you have too many carbs, extra sugar, then all of that sugar will get processed and turned into fat in the liver. People who have diabetes have insulin resistance. And so the signaling that happens in the liver, the hormones in the body, actually trick the liver to holding on to the fat. So the fat is created by your body trying to store sugar and other things in the liver as fat. And then for some people, that fat irritates the liver, and that's where all of the damage starts happening.
But just as a note, though, you don't necessarily need to have diabetes, right, to get fatty liver.
Yeah, 100%, right? So diabetes, many people, if not most people with diabetes, have fat in their liver. You do not need just diabetes. It's just a very powerful risk factor. But other risk factors are going to be overweight, the metabolic syndrome without diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, and then there are some genetic things that run in families.
So you talked a little bit about alcohol, you talked a little bit about fatty liver. In terms of, I mean, I'm sure, Turner, you've heard of plenty of, I'm sure, comedians, you know, who have drank their liver to the point of cirrhosis, musicians for the same matter, you know.
Yes.
So that's, I think, pretty common. People understand you drink enough, you'll scar your liver to a point where it doesn't return. I think everyone gets that. I think it's more surprising for people to know that fatty changes in the liver can do the same thing. Elliot, do you have a sense of which is more common now in the United States? What are the most common causes of this cirrhosis or scarring of the liver?
Yeah. So like, it's probably the case that somewhere around 40, 50 million people have fat or steatotic liver disease. And then about 12% of those people have the extra inflammation or so forth. And about 2 million Americans have cirrhosis in total. The most common cause of cirrhosis is this, the fatty liver or the steatotic liver disease. But the most common reason why people die or get jaundiced, yellow skin, and so forth, that's actually alcohol, because it's much, the alcohol is so much more toxic and people get so much sicker. And so one of the reasons why the prevalence of the non-alcoholic type of liver disease is higher is because you're less likely to die in the short term because of it.
Yeah.
What about, I've always heard that you could drink for your, as long that the liver could recover on its own. That was something you, like when you're younger, they always said that. So you drink as long as you want. It was like being a Christian, like drink as long as you want, as long as at the end you're like, no, I believe in God now. Boom. You're in heaven. You and Tony Soprano are up in heaven. You're good. You know, well, is that the case?
That's one of my favorite parts about this job, is that it's never too late to try to cut back or stop the thing that's upsetting the liver. And so I'll meet people with straight up liver failure who their liver will recover almost all the way. Now, I would not tempt fate that you don't, there's a chance that it will not recover once you get severe liver failure, but we meet
pretty people. Good chance to make that clear.
Like, are you saying I took the wrong message out of that story?
So, there's a very good chance, but I still remain hopeful. The thing is that if you start earlier, when there's just fat in the liver, that is 100% reversible. Then if you have inflammation and fat, that's likely 100% reversible too, just with weight loss or exercise. Then when you start getting into the place where there's cirrhosis, there are many people that can actually reverse that or get it to a place where you'll never get symptoms. But there are much more people that will not reverse it, could develop liver failure or liver cancer as a result. So much harder to reverse things the sicker you get, although it still happens.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So tell us a little bit about this change in nomenclature. We've been calling it fatty liver disease or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD. But recently there's been a change. Tell us about that and tell us why that happened.
Yeah. So the main reason for the changes in our society and in Europe was to get rid of the word fatty, which was perceived to be stigmatizing for patients. And so this is now like such a common thing. We got to go out there and find people with this condition and then get them to realize that the health of their liver is at stake and change and turn things around. And there was a concern that the word fatty was a barrier to that. So they went through a very long process. They got hundreds of groups involved to try to come up with a new name. And the name they chose is a bit of a mouthful, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. That's the new name for fatty liver disease. And it remains to be seen whether or not people think that it's non-stigmatizing, because sometimes you tell somebody you have this condition, which we pronounce mazzled, and they'll say, well, what does steatotic mean? And Well, it means fatty. So some patients really don't want to hear the word fatty, and some patients don't care. So I would be interested to see what ends up happening in the long run about whether it improves our relations with the community or reduces stigma. I don't know. What do you think, Turner?
I think that what's the goal? I mean, is the goal to get people to shock them into reality and say, hey, you're not treating your body correctly. Time to turn it around. I would say fatty's not far enough. I would go, you know, what's a worse? I mean, what we need to be, this is serious. This isn't games. This isn't like we all need to feel good about ourselves. This is time to turn your life around. This is like death's door, it sounds like. So I think if you're now using words that, if you were to tell me you have, and then you said six words I don't understand, I would probably be like, yeah, cool. And then I just go back to watching football. But if you told me,
okay,
you have fatty.
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
Like, but the word cancer, right? That's a serious word. We all know that word. And I'm being serious here.
No,
you
I get
somebody they have cancer, they go,
A couple of things to that. One, I will say this. We are concerned about fatty liver, but that doesn't mean that everyone who has fatty liver is going to be at death's door. I mean, it's very common. You see it all the time.
Okay, so I'm wrong.
It doesn't always mean they're at death's door. But I do agree it's serious and it needs to be taken seriously. I don't love Mazzled. I don't think it's got good branding. I don't think it's going to go across that well. But at the same time, isn't it weird that we have this term fatty liver? It doesn't seem very scientific. You know, it'd be like calling cancer like yucky mass syndrome. You have like, oh, you have yucky mass syndrome in your body. You have yucky mass of the colon. We have to get your yucky mass out. You know what I mean? It just doesn't sound very like scientific.
What's a word that you all know? I mean, you guys have a better resource to pick your brains for certain words. What's a word that everybody knows that's also like alarm bells sounding? Like, oh boy, I got to turn this around. Then a word that already exists in the nomenclature, not a word that we're making up that sounds German vaguely.
That's a good question.
Like massive, you know?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I mean,
emergency or something.
Liver steatosis. I see what you're saying. Like dropping in something into the title that for both the doctor and the layperson
shocks us.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a great question. Liver attack.
Liver attack. We have heart attack. We have heart attacks.
Yeah.
Why not liver attacks?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a really good question because I gotta be honest with you. I don't love it. It is a mouthful, and I don't know. I'm gonna try using it. I'm gonna go with it. You know, because maybe it will catch on and it'll work. I'm curious,
is it true that sentence number two, you tell them you have Mazel and then they go, what's that? And then sentence number two is, well, you have fatty liver. Like,
yeah,
explain it by using the thing we're not supposed to use anymore. Yeah. And then they go, oh, okay, I got it. Yeah.
I mean, that is sort of the case. I mean, we have to like, it's like the same way we'll be like, you know, you have a blank centimeter mass and they'll be like, what? And you'll be like, it's a grapefruit. We have to put things in terms of like fruit. You know what I mean? Because a lot of Americans just don't understand centimeters is, you know, that's how we deal with things in medicine. So we have to like designate it as a fruit or
we want a war so we don't have to know what centimeters are. That was the whole point.
That's right. So speaking of that, though, how do we fare, Elliot, in the U.S. versus other countries in terms of Mazzled or fatty liver disease?
You know, it used to be the case that we would focus a lot on just how much Mazzled there was in the U.S., and we have a really high percentage. But I think a lot of that was because we were pretty transparent and we were doing a lot of the early research on this. And now the risk of Mazzled in India might be higher by a proportion of the population. And certainly in China, it's viewed as a health emergency. And all throughout, the UK and Europe, it is considered a serious problem. There's less data about this sort of thing in Africa, but it is still an emerging global problem.
That is interesting to me because, you know, we do like just commonly associate it with obesity, for example. That's the sort of most obvious marker that people use. Not the only one. You can get it without obvious obesity. But you lived in China for a good portion of time, too.
12 years.
So, it's great. So are these places becoming more obese? Is that part of it, or is it something else?
I mean, I'll say this. When I was living in China, this is a true stat. They were building a new KFC every day.
Wow.
Kentucky Fried Chicken. Every single day, there was a new one going in. And that was for real. There was an average of over 365 a year. There was like 370 a year were being built for like a 10-year period. I mean, diets are changing for the worse. I think that's at least in China, where I don't think anyone would disagree with that. I don't think any like Chinese study would. I didn't do an actual poll here, but you could just look around and see compared to what they were previously eating before Western foods and influence came in and all that stuff. Definitely processed. I don't know if more sugary foods. I mean, I guess you have the data with
processed foods, the more processed foods you get, the more sugar is going to be in those processed foods. It's just a part of making processed foods like work. It's the easiest thing for them to do to a processed food is to turn up the sugar in it. Elliot, is there any sense of why it's growing in these other countries?
Yeah, I think that in general, what you hear is that we've exported the Western diet. And these sorts of
USA, about... USA, USA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, like the anecdotes about KFC are the ones that you hear. And it's definitely about increasing the amount of carbs and just overall volume of calories that people are consuming meal by meal.
So is it actually getting more common, or is it just being diagnosed more?
Both. I mean, it is definitely more common and being diagnosed more, but is and it's in parallel with trends in obesity. And so we definitely have been monitoring the average BMI by age group, and that has been going up, and it tracks perfectly with that. So it's not just that we're now measuring it more through like liver enzymes or ultrasounds. It's independent of that.
I could also say, I should come clean and say, I did run a Mr. Softy ice cream truck business in China for 10 years.
Wait, did you really?
But we weren't that successful. Yes, I had 10 trucks and 2 stores, but we couldn't have made that big of a dent. You know, I wasn't, luckily for them, I wasn't a good enough businessman to really go full national with it.
You're the one. But, you're the reason it's happened.
I would imagine those numbers... if I did my job right, those numbers spiked in Suzhou, China between 2006 and 2016. But
this is a tough conversation. I have to say, this is a really tough conversation because as doctors, we have over the last, you know, however many years we've been following this or caring about this, you know, pretty much forever, doctors have not done a good job of discussing weight. And we have not done a good job of addressing people who might be overweight or talking to them about their health. And for that reason, we've lost some of the public trust when it comes to discussing this stuff. It's hard to have a discussion based on weight these days or talk about people's weights. And people are a little more sensitive to that. And I understand why. I feel like as doctors, we've made people feel pretty bad about themselves. I mean, I think it came from a good place. I think doctors wanted to help people. But because I think there hasn't been a lot of sensitivity to this issue, we've lost a little bit of the goodwill in regards to having these conversations. So it is hard, I think, to have this conversation sometimes. Not for everyone. Some patients are like, yeah, fat. I mean, you can say I'm obese. I get it. I'm like, whatever. And some patients don't care. But other patients do. So, Elliot, how do you manage this conversation? How do you talk to people about their weight in a way that is understanding of where they might be coming from?
You know, I'm privileged because people have been filtered through by the time that they meet me. They've been sort of coached or the idea has been planted before they see me. And I try to start out non-judgmentally and just if someone asks, well, how come this isn't happening to somebody who weighs more or my brother who weighs more than me, then I just explain that it's for they're too heavy for their liver doesn't like their specific weight, or that is just the cards that they were dealt. I try to make sure that they see it as something they have control over, but not necessarily something that they're directly responsible for. And so the goal is to try to make small, attainable lifestyle changes that can result in at least a 5% body weight loss. And so once you get people sold on the idea that they can make an improvement, that the liver does get better, then you have to try to link that future goal to small changes like dropping out sugars in what they're drinking, looking at what they're snacking on, and so forth. And I find that people are so excited to have concrete advice about what they ought to be eating, that they, whatever displeasure they had with the idea that they could have been somehow responsible for their liver condition, once they are told what could make them healthy, they're ready to run with it.
I agree. I like that. I also try to emphasize that it's not about putting blame on it. It's not like it's your fault you did this to yourself. I mean, this, we all do things to ourselves constantly, and some people just get away with it and don't have liver problems at all. And that's just, some people are going to be heavier and they're going to be fine. Some people are going to be heavy and their labs are going to be great. Their ultrasound, their liver looks great. And that's great. That's who they are. And they're fine like that. But a lot of people don't. And it's not, I don't think, I never want to put blame on a person, even if it's like they smoke and they get lung cancer. I mean, I don't think there's any benefit in saying, oh, you did this to yourself. I mean, because lots of people smoke and don't get lung cancer. So it's, I always try to take that component out of it and make it clear that we're not about judging either way. This is about, look, this is something in your liver and this could cause problems. And here's how we recommend treating it. And weight loss is a big part of that. I mean, as of now, that's the best way, right? Elliot, tell us what the treatments are and then maybe what's coming down the pipeline.
Okay. So the first line treatment is going to be weight loss, and it's remarkably effective. It's amazing to see it. But around 7.5% body weight loss, you start to see a resolution of the inflammation, and around 10 or 12% people can start to heal up and undo some of the scar tissue. It's once you start at about 5% body weight loss, your health-related quality of life, if you do a scientific questionnaire about how good you feel, it improves by 10%. So people feel better and their liver is much healthier and it recovers. Now, sometimes it's hard to do that with just diet or exercise alone. So what else can we do? Well, currently there are no FDA-approved medications. We trained in an era where we were giving people vitamin E. Vitamin E can reduce the amount of inflammation in the liver, interestingly, but many of us don't use it. Right now, it looks like the most effective fatty or steatotic liver disease drugs are going to be the GLP-1 receptor agonists. This is the Ozempics, Wegovys, Mounjaros, semaglutide, tirzepatide. These are medications that help with weight loss, and it's substantial. There will probably be an approval next year, if not in 2024 and 2025, of a drug called resmetirom. And resmetirom is a thyroid receptor agonist. So basically what this does is it changes the way the liver cell metabolizes things. It probably improves cholesterol at the same point. So it doesn't help with weight loss, but it does change the amount of inflammation and scar tissue in the liver. But that hasn't been approved yet. So long story short, right now we have weight loss medications, and then we will start to see these new drugs that come out that play with the metabolism of the liver to change the amount of scar tissue or inflammation, the first of which has this name, resmetirom.
I have a couple questions. When you say it's only 10%, that actually sounds attainable, 10% weight loss. So for example, if someone weighs 400 pounds, if they lose 40 pounds, that does the trick.
Yeah. So they may have more to go to improve their overall health, but there's diminishing returns. Like that first 10% is a massive investment in their future. They will feel better. They will have improved life expectancy and liver health. So they should keep going, and we have to support them. But after you get there, then you're more than halfway in terms of liver health.
Yeah, sorry. I would imagine people would think that, oh, like if I weigh 400 pounds, I have to lose 200 pounds to even make any difference. This feels impossible. But that message, it's just like 10% gets you going. That seems really good.
Very impressive math you just did off the. That was very just nice little flex you did there with the math. I was told there would be no math on the show.
Knowing 10%,
it was pretty good. Speaking of you know diets and that sort of thing, is there any particular diet you do recommend to these people, or you just say you kind of let them figure it out on their own, or do you recommend a certain type of diet?
Well, you know, there's practice, variation in practice here. So I'll hear what you have to say too. But, you know, we sort of grew up in this era where the Mediterranean diet was hyped. And I don't know about you, but not all of my patients can afford salmon and olive oil, extra virgin olive oil and so forth. So that is definitely good, right? The Mediterranean diet. So recommend it. But if I had to go for the gold, the first thing I would cut out of a diet is if anybody drinks a calorie. So don't ever drink a sugar soda. Don't put sugar in your coffee. It just go water or flavored water or seltzer or whatever. That's number one. Number two, I have them cut out potatoes. I ask them to imagine a plate and put a bunch of green things and meat on that plate and nothing white on it or only a sliver of it. And I go after chips, pasta, rice, anything. So as long as we're eating more vegetables and less starches, we've got it made. What are you doing?
Yeah, I agree. You know what I'll do is I'll be like, Turner, tell me like what is the most quintessential American food you could think of?
Burgers.
Exactly. I'm not like even opposed to all the ingredients in a burger, but the problem is our proportions are totally off and what those are. Like you think about it, we have like a big piece of bread, a big piece of meat, maybe two big pieces of meat, maybe cheese, maybe a little bit of like lettuce and an onion, maybe a red onion, maybe, and then another bun. I'm not opposed to all those ingredients. I mean, a plant-based diet would be amazing, but that's hard for people to do. That's hard for me to do it fully. But, you know, I'd say the problem is our proportions are off. That little bit of lettuce, that little bit of onion, that little tomato that might be there, that should be the main thing in that meal. And the little bit of meat, the little bit of cheese, the little bit of bread, that should be things that are there just to ornament the meal, make it better and to help it taste better. But that shouldn't be the centerpiece of the meal. That is our fundamental problem. So I try to like start with that discussion first and let people know that we kind of have it backwards. Like we have to start looking at food a little differently here. And then, you know, if possible, the more plant-based things you can get in, the better. I don't think people should necessarily always cut out all meat. It'd be great if they did. I mean, but I couldn't. I wouldn't expect anyone else to. But what I try and say is consolidate your meat meals. So instead of having like three or four shitty hamburgers a month, have like one good steak dinner. Like have one good meal where it's like really good meat, quality meat if you can't afford it, you know, as opposed to a bunch of different hamburgers. And then exactly cutting out processed sugars, cutting out sugars that you drink, sodas, those are the things that just need to go because those are the easiest way to do it. That's the quickest and easiest way to do it. And so many people do that.
What about diet sodas and like zero soda, you know, like Coke Zero, that kind of stuff? What do you guys stand on that?
My take is that as long as you're not drinking sugar, then you are ahead. I was once on a drive time radio show for like Detroit in the morning, and I made a comment that I would have people switch from sugar sodas to diet sodas, and I was cut off immediately because the radio host said he could never recommend diet sodas to his listeners because it causes so many health problems. And I drink diet soda. I recommend it as a way of switching it off. If you can drink water, then that's okay. As long as it's not sugar, then it's much better. There's no evidence that it causes liver harm. It's just about substitution.
Yeah, it kind of comes down to this whole argument of like harm reduction, you know, like safe needle spaces. Like I don't love diet sodas. I think there's lots of stuff in the soda that's not sugar, that's still not good for you. I'm not a big fan of them. I am a big proponent of coffee. Elliot actually came on an episode we did with
Sanjeev Chopra.
Yeah, right. Deepak Chopra's brother and Prop the rapper. And we talked about this for a while. I am a big fan of coffee. I think it's helpful for the liver, and I recommend it black without anything in it. That's like the one nice thing I can tell patients, you know, when I'm like, don't, you know, drink and watch your diet, all that stuff. So I like that, but, you know, I agree. It's better than the option. If the option is a Coke or a Diet Coke, I'd rather it be a Diet Coke. So I agree with that. Even though I don't love either. It's kind of like, vaping. I don't love vaping. I think there's a lot of problems with vaping, but it's probably better than smoking cigarettes. Probably. I'm on the same boat.
Like 10 out of 10 hepatologists are recommending coffee. So
yeah.
Can you all recommend exercise? Cause it sounds like losing weight. Like, can you prescribe? I had a bulging disc in my back, and I got prescribed physical therapy, which is essentially different versions of light exercise and stretching. Can you do the same thing for this scenario?
So even for people who don't lose weight, but they start exercising, the muscle, when it gets tired, will actually pull fat out of the liver to use for energy. It improves insulin sensitivity. And so pound for pound, people who are exercising but stay the same still have less fat in their liver overall. So it's hard for a hepatologist to figure out how to tailor an exercise recommendation in clinic. But if someone is coming to me, they were recently in the military, I'm not really worried about giving them advice. I just tell them to huff and puff and make sure that they're sweating at least 3 times a week. But if they're old and I'm worried about frailty, I'll start off slow and just add minute by minute. And I try to emphasize resistance exercise.
Yeah. Shouldn't gyms be covered by health insurance? If all this is so much, it goes towards benefiting your health. Why can't we just get gym memberships that $100 a month is covered, or $50 a month, or whatever?
It's a pretty brilliant idea. I don't know. Does any country do that? I mean,
I don't know, but it seems so preventative and relatively cheap. I mean, like the Planet Fitness is $10 a month. And if a doctor could say, yeah, I prescribe you 3 times a week, and there's a guy down there who's going to give you the workout, just like you go to physical therapy.
Actually, that's a really good point. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you were a gym and you struck a deal with a big insurance company, you're probably going to do very well with that, because, you know, truthfully, the majority of people won't go. And it'll probably be a small percentage of people who actually use it. I don't know. I have no answer. That's pretty reasonable.
And if a doctor could then send you there, and they know the person on the other side, if it's all within the system, if they can prescribe, if you can prescribe drugs and even physical therapy is so close. It's one step away from just go to the gym and get on a treadmill for 20 minutes and this guy will watch you.
Yeah, no, that's although have you ever had a trainer?
I did it one time for like a short term thing in China, and it was useful. But yeah, I haven't done it in America, so I can't say.
All right. Let's go to some listener questions. Actually, you had covered pretty much all the listener questions, I think, already. But there's one that I think we should get to. It's from Karen Percy at Karen Percy at Blue Sky. That's a multi-part one, but I'll go to the last part of it because I think we should address this part. It kind of comes back to what we discussed in the beginning, which is, if you are diagnosed with fatty liver disease or MASLD, should you moderate or change your alcohol consumption?
So the answer is yes. The alcohol is like fuel for the fire. And when you add alcohol to known fatty liver disease, it's much more likely to progress to end stages than otherwise. At the same time, it's like, it's very challenging to regulate people's behaviors when you know that what they're doing is relatively limited. So there's never a time that a liver doctor is going to recommend alcohol. No, not in moderation, not wine. There's never going to be that. That will never happen. But, you know, one glass every now and then is unlikely to be the problem. The issue is that I don't have any control over that. So I don't recommend any amount of alcohol. In fact, we see a lot of overlap. And so within this family of MASLD, there's a category where it's like the MASLD combined with alcohol. And we see that pretty commonly. And so oftentimes in clinic, I will ask people about alcohol, and I might even check their blood for chronic alcohol exposure to get a truly objective sense of how much they're drinking. And if it's high, we'll have an honest conversation about the sum total of things that people can do to improve the health of their liver in the long run.
Turner, you mentioned to me that, and I checked to make sure it was okay to bring this up on air. You mentioned to me that you stopped drinking recently. Tell me a little bit about why you decided to do that.
Yes. Yeah, so I stopped drinking in 2019, like 3 months before the pandemic hit America.
Bad time.
Unrelated, but just to give you a time frame of when it was. And it was, I had had 5 years of chronic back pain. I had had this bulging disc that was pinching a nerve, and the nerve, sciatica was shooting down my legs. And the doctor would prescribe me physical therapy. I would go for 6 weeks, nothing would happen. And then I would come back and he'd be like, "You seem good to me." And then I would go home and have pain for years and years and years. And so eventually I talked, my friend's wife was a nutritionist, and she's like, "Why don't you try like an elimination diet?" So I did that, which I don't, would the audience be familiar, but this idea is that you take everything that could be harmful out of your body and then you put it back in one by one, meaning sugar, bread, things. And then alcohol was one of those things. And not only harmful, but also they do it with like tomatoes. You can go as deep as you want into this idea, every possible ingredient. So I just went, I think caffeine, sugar, gluten, and alcohol. And I just said, I'm taking all of those out for like a year. And I did that just out of desperation to try to make myself feel better. And I would say I felt about within 2 months, about 80% better. And within like, I had this for 5 years. I couldn't exercise at all for 5 years. Some days when it was really bad, I couldn't walk to the end of my block. And 3 months after cutting those things out, I was skiing in the mountains and I was playing, I was light basketball exercise. About 6 to 8 months or maybe 12 months later, I was running. And eventually I started putting everything back in one by one, meaning like the gluten, meaning the light amounts of sugar, not a ton of sugar. And then when I tried to put the alcohol back in, maybe a year and a half later, I had a few drinks one night. And then the next day I was fine. I had a couple drinks the next day. And then after that, the back pain came back right away. And so I just went, all right, never again. That's the end of that.
That is really interesting.
And now I run 4 days a week. I'm like,
did anything else change other than your diet? Did your weight change during this time?
I'm about 10 to 15 pounds lighter than I was at that time. But I don't know if that's drastic. I was 165. I'm 150 now.
Well,
but that could have been because I wasn't exercising also.
Okay. How much were you drinking beforehand, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no problem. I was drinking probably, I would say probably 14 drinks a week or maybe a little more. Mm-hmm. I would, you know, two or three nights a week and drink. When I would drink like probably 5 or 6 drinks, I would say. I don't know.
Elliot, exactly. What do you think? Have you heard of this? I mean, can you rationalize an explanation for why the alcohol may have affected his back pain in that way?
You know, I have to be humble and accept that I'm just happy that there's an improvement. But while I don't have an explanation for that, and I think you were trying to get at one, which is that there's calories in alcohol. And when you cut back on alcohol, there's weight loss. And also alcohol is a neurotoxin. It can cause neuropathy. It can cause depression. It can worsen pain. And so with that aside, it's just your ability to cope and handle pain from the body is better. But like for you, it's just, I'm happy. And for the patients I see in clinic who don't have that problem, back pain, but they have a variety of other things that get better when they stop drinking. And those things include the health of their liver, weight, sexual function, well-being, ability to cope with their family and other stressors. And then everything starts getting better when they're finally able to put alcohol behind. It might be tough up front to stop something that was part of your life habitually. But after a while, when they can look back and just see how much better things feel and how easier it is to think, it's quite rewarding. So don't have an explanation for that story, but I think it's a common one, which is just that alcohol kind of sucks when it be, the less of it we drink, the better.
You know, I would say that I've seen patients where there's, and I don't know if your liver actually had injury due to the alcohol or not, but I've seen patients where there is some chronic liver inflammation, and they, for whatever reason, whether it's viral or something else, they then remove that. It gets solved or treated, or the insult to the liver goes away and that inflammation goes away, and then they feel better. And they didn't even know they weren't feeling great beforehand, or they feel better once that whatever cytotoxins, or I don't know what's going on that's being released from the liver that in those situations, but they'll feel better once their liver looks better. I have seen that. Haven't you, Elliot?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it was some component of that too, but.
Well, I'll say that any doctor I've brought this up to, and I went away from the back doctors and got to neurologists, and that's how that also helped. I mean, 80% of it was solved by quitting alcohol. And then the final 20%, I was on, amitriptyline for a little while, well, for 2 years, I guess, which a very low dose, 25 milligrams once a day before I went to bed. Mm-hmm. And that seemingly got the nerves under control, but I'm now off of that and I'm just fine.
Oh man, that's great. So, I will also add this. I mean, I will tell my patients this sometimes too, when there is like this is not necessarily a mystery problem, but if there is like a problem where there's not an obvious answer or solution, and we've done the basic workup to see if there's something obvious that we can find, I'll tell them a lot of times that, you know, one of two things will happen. Either one, it'll present itself. It'll eventually develop into something that we can diagnose and treat, or it'll go away and we'll pretend it's something that we did. And I'm very upfront about that because there's a lot of stuff we just don't know, you know, and that it will it resolve on its own with time. And the patients are finding their own ways to manage this. They're doing little things. They're adjusting their daily routines in these really microscopic ways that over time can help. So I'm always glad to hear it, even if it's not something that we totally have a grasp on. So we are not the end all be all of health. Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm glad to hear it. Is it hard being a comedian without drinking? Was that part of your act? Did you have to like go up on stage with a drink?
No, I never drank before shows, but I would drink after. It's actually way easier to be a comedian now because I'm on the road a ton. Like to make this podcast, I just came back from Dallas. I was in Dallas 2 nights ago. A lot of weekends I'm on the road. So it's being on stage late at night, getting up and making the 6 a.m. flight the next morning to get to the next city or to get home. And when you add alcohol and hangovers to all of that, getting up at 6 a.m., it's like you're running yourself ragged. Yeah. And when you take all that out, you can get to the next city and be fine at noon. You know, you sleep on the plane an hour or two and then you're good to go for the next day. So it's a way easier job. And being on stage, when you're sober and everyone in the audience is drunk, you can handle hecklers so much better. You have this superpower above them. You're thinking with clarity and you know they're not. And so you also have that confidence of being like, I can handle anyone in this room right now. It was Friday night in Dallas. There was like 6 of them in the front row, all at different tables. And I was just going through picking people off. They started it in all cases. I never start this with audiences. I'm not like the takedown a heckler guy. That's not my bag. But if it comes at me, I can defend myself. So I had to do it the other night. And it ends up the job's way easier.
That's fantastic. If you have questions about that, listeners, go back to our episode, whatever, 170 or whatever, where we talked about hecklers with Turner and Johnny Taylor as well. That's a good one. So,
yes.
All right. Well, listen, that was really great, guys. I appreciate your time. This has been a good discussion. I hope people are walking away with a little bit more understanding of fatty liver disease. People have been asking me to do an episode about it for a while. I've just sort of been like, I don't know, just like something you do every day at work. You know, you're like, I'm like, I kind of want to bring other new things to the podcast that I can learn about more. But having you here, Elliot's great because you always have a deeper understanding of most things liver. So it's always great to have you. And it's good to have a conversation with you both about it. So hopefully the listeners took something away from this too. Anyways, let's get some plugs in real quick. So Elliot, if people want to learn more about you, your studies, your papers, your stance on pickle juice and its importance, where can they do that?
You could follow me on PubMed.gov at TapperEB, or I'll still be tweeting.
Yeah,
EB Tapper, or you can see me on Blue Sky.
I recommend following him. He is constantly updating us on, you know, what's happening and what's hot in the world of liver, and he does it in a way that's very understandable and approachable. So that's huge. So it's not just he's like one of these high end like liver guys in the country. You're like looking.
I feel like I just got a free doctor's visit.
He's like a big deal in the world of liver in the United States. He won't say that. I'm making him blush right now.
Yes, I'm picking up on that.
But like, he's also like, he's able to talk to people on sort of a human level, which is hard when you get to the higher echelons of like academia. They usually get weirder and weirder and less approachable. He's somehow maintained that ability to have that conversation, and I enjoy making him uncomfortable right now. Turner, where can people find you?
Yeah, so find me at Turner Sparks, spelled just like it sounds, SPARKS. Turner Sparks on Instagram. I put up new stand-up videos all the time. TurnerSparks.com for my tour dates. Listen to my podcast, Lost in America. We're talking about gun control in Serbia on the most recent episode. They're trying to take 90% of guns off the streets, which was easy to do in Australia when they did that 30 years ago, and the Australians always brag about that. But Serbia is a heavily armed country, like another country we might all know. So it's a better test case for us.
Yeah, Serbia's been through some shit, so I feel like that's a harder thing to.
A lot of guns there.
Yeah, wow. All right, well, I'm going to check that one out. And if you get a chance to check out Turner live, please do so. Watching comedy live is one of the things that, like, as I've sort of come to grips with COVID and I've started going out to things again, going to comedy is such an important one. I didn't even realize how much I missed. So I really highly recommend it. And Turner, we got to get you out here to San Francisco for a show soon. Come on, man.
Oh, I'm coming. It's in November. I'll be at the Throckmorton Theater.
Oh, nice. In Marin, yeah.
In Mill Valley.
Yeah, yeah. Very nice theater. The Grateful Dead dudes are up there playing a lot. It's a very fun little place. I like it. Yeah, I'll be there, buddy.
November 14th.
November 14th at the Throckmorton Theater in Mill Valley. Very cute little quaint downtown area. If you get a chance, go check it out. I'll be there. Thank you to Nadine for help with production. If you haven't already, rate and review us. I love reading the reviews that you guys leave on iTunes. They're super fun for me. So please keep doing that. If you have questions, I am checking the email again at hopquestions@gmail.com. So thank you again for listening. And thank you guys so much for coming on. Love you both.
Love you too.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employers. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to save. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready to burn this fire within. Let's begin.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.